Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, in a nod to the Olympics, Devorah Myers will talk about the history and practice of women's gymnastics. And at the bottom of the hour, Arun Gupta will tell us about the dark side of the SEIU-sponsored Fight for 15, with a footnote on the sexual violence surrounding the Trump campaign. First, Devorah Myers. Devorah was a gymnast in childhood who had to give it up because of some nasty injuries. But she's developed that base of experience into knowledgeable and thoughtful journalism about the sport. Her book, The End of the Perfect 10, The Making and Breaking of Gymnastics Top Score from Nadia to Now, was published by Touchstone in July. The title refers to the transformation of scoring in gymnastics from the maximum score of 10, made famous by Nadia Comaneci in the 1976 Olympics in Montreal, to an open-ended scoring system today. We don't talk about that much in this interview, but if you're interested in the sport, the story of the scoring change and its influence on gymnastics is one of several reasons to buy this book. Sports are largely a mystery to me, but I do try to step out of the realm of the entirely familiar now and then. Devorah Myers.
You say at one point in the book that gymnastics has some kind of a militaristic past. Like, mm-hmm. Where did this sport emerge from?
The sport emerged from, at least in the modern version, emerged in the late 19th century in places like Germany and Czechoslovakia. Those are the earliest originators. And some of the elements were used in military training. And obviously also athletes have long been considered military proxies of the state. So you see it in when they march out, and there's a lot of this sort of military sort of ceremony associated with gymnastics. Even the way that the young girls like march out like they're little soldiers and saluting, and there's all these sort of trappings of its militaristic past from the late 19th century in the sport.
Lincoln Kirsten, I think, said that ballet was structured like an army. I mean, mm-hmm. Is there some aspect of this way the sport is run that is also army-like?
I think it applies to a lot of sports. I think it just looks funny when we think about it on young girls. Yeah, definitely ballet, especially with the Soviet influence, brought a lot of ballet in as well. They really came into the sport in the early 50s, and they brought in a lot of that as well. But yeah, I think it comes from the late 19th century and then also the influence of ballet in the sport.
Women's gymnastics has changed a lot over the decades. So let's do a little potted history. The 40s and 50s, it was very feminine.
Yeah, it was very feminine. Up until 1952, the events in women's gymnastics were in flux. So you would go to a competition, and sometimes women would be competing on the parallel bars or on the flying rings. And it wasn't until the 52 Olympics where the events had really sort of standardized to the four events that we now view as women's gymnastics: the vault, the uneven bars, the balance beam floor exercise. And those events were not chosen randomly. Three of the four events are leg events. And typically women are not known for having as strong upper bodies as men. So you gave them three essentially leg events and only really one dynamic event, which was the vault at that time, because all the other events were much slower, less dynamic, more dancey. And they didn't really even flip in the 40s. If you look at maybe saw a walkover or a handstand, I remember talking to a member of the 1948 U.S. Women's Olympic team, and she said that doing things like handstands on the balance beam were discouraged for them. They said that she said some of her teammates could do stuff like that. But really, if you look at these old videos from the 30s and 40s on YouTube, and you can find them, it's just like they're just like standing statically on like one leg, and it's just so not the sport that we now know and that became famous in the 70s.
Yeah, the 70s, of course, are when women's gymnastics really entered popular consciousness,
mm-hmm.
And it was the era of the skinny girl. How did that become the ideal type of the female gymnast?
You know, I think people became aware of it in the 70s, but one of the things I talk about in the book is how that shift started in the 60s. When you actually start to see the teenage girls start to emerge, they just didn't get Olga Korbut famous or Nadia Comaneci famous. But I think in 64 or 66, the Soviet national championships were won by a 15-year-old girl. 68, you had Ludmila Tarasheva. She was 15 at the time on the Soviet team. So you're already starting to see those shifts, and that's when it becomes really apparent with Olga Korba in 1972 and again with Nadia in 1976. And I think the shifts start to happen because the sport becomes more acrobatic and more dynamic, and that works better with shorter, lighter bodies because they rotate through space easier.
And, of course, it was also embedded very much in a Cold War era. Lots of questions about judging. and then, of course, the powerhouses in the 70s were, the Soviet Union, East Germany, and then Romania. How did gymnastics fit into international geopolitics?
The 76 was when Romania sort of took over second banana status from East Germany, because up until 76, East Germany and the Soviet Union really went one and two all the time. The fact that we became so obsessed with it, we wanted our athletes to do well against these Eastern Bloc powers. And if you read, like, U.S. gymnastics magazines from around that time, which I have, there is a lot of obsession of, like, how do we beat these, you know, Soviets? Like, why? And, like, I guess the question that always struck me is that we had all these sports that we were really good at. Like, why did we need gymnastics in addition? But it become the, like, most popular sport at the games and the most televised sport at the games and the most watched sport. So I think it was really became really important for the West to start doing well in a sport that I guess they had previously ignored for the most part.
As I recall, the time people always thought there was something, like, you know, sinister and conspiratorial about the way these Eastern Bloc countries would make it a matter of state priority to produce these fabulous athletes. And we thought it was kind of unfair. So what were the Americans up to at this time?
Well, I would say in the late 60s into the early 70s, the private club system that now exists didn't really exist that much. There were just a handful of private clubs where super elite gymnasts could go for training. And gymnasts were coming out still of community programs, out of YMCAs. For the men's gymnastics, the training ground was still is, but was even more so the NCAA system. So it was more of a community-based, not a full-time professional program. And we didn't necessarily think that it was a great thing for, you know, young athletes to be training 6 hours a day. I mean, the Soviets and the Romanians were training 6 hours a day, generally twice a day, and things like education were not prioritized. So the East German system is interesting, is that if you read the accounts of their gymnasts, or at least the women, most of those women ended up being really successful professionally and getting really great education. There was one gymnast who went on to become a doctor. Like, that was one bright spot, that some of the East German gymnasts seemed to find, you know, really interesting professional lives that had nothing to do with gymnastics afterwards.
And then, of course, the perfect 10 happened. What was the story of the perfect 10?
I think the story of the perfect 10 is it doesn't really truly start with Nadia. It starts with Nadia at this Olympic level, and she makes it famous. Nadia had actually gone at 10 earlier at the American Cup in 1976, so this wasn't so unprecedented. And there have been 10s at Pan Am Championships or, you know, smaller competitions or NCAA competitions. But this moment obviously made the sport famous, you know, and especially when it came at this the 1976 Olympics, where there was, like, a day after the African boycott had been announced. So it already looked like things were going to go badly at the 1976 Olympics, and I think people were looking for something to, like, latch onto. And then you have this 14-year-old girl from Romania, and at the time, and I think it still stands, we didn't really know much about Romania. Nadia herself said to me, you know, I think part of the allure and her mystique was the fact that she was so mysterious, much more mysterious than the Soviets, with whom we had, like, this rivalry. So we kind of, like, had some sense of who they were. We didn't like them, but we had a sense of who they were. With Romania, we had, like, you know, Dracula, Transylvania. I would imagine that it was also appealing for a Western audience on some level to watch the Soviets get beaten by a 14-year-old girl, you know, and they really did get their butts kicked pretty hard by her.
The sport has changed over the last 40 years at the waif has given way to rather beefy body types. How'd that happen, and what's that done to the sport?
Well, it started happening, I think, before the open-ended scoring system came into being. And I think there's just so many more skills in a routine. If you go back and look at routines from, let's say, the 80s, you would see gymnasts doing some skills, like the double twisting, double somersault, which is still a really, really hard skill in women's full exercise, was done first by a Romanian gymnast in 1988. But she didn't have, like, four tumbling passes that were like that, of the same level of difficulty. So even when the gymnasts back then did these very hard skills, they didn't have to survive routines that had four hard passes. Maybe that crazy pass was just the only crazy pass in the routine. So you really have to, in order to sort of be able to repeat these skills over and over and stay relatively uninjured, because obviously in gymnastics, everyone's a little bit beat up. If they're lucky, you know, it's a lot worse if they're not. So the way that the athletes are conditioned and the way they're prepared is different than it used to be. I think if you look across all sports, athletes are better conditioned than ever before. If you look at basketball players back in the 70s and 80s and you look at them now, if you look at any players in any sports, even there's this great article talking to the gymnasts in the men's 1984 team that won the gold medal in Los Angeles, and those guys were saying that they never worked with weights, never did all these things that gymnasts these days do. So I think part of this is just an improvement in conditioning that is spread across all sports. I think part of it's also the particular demands of this more athletic, more acrobatic gymnastics in order to withstand the rigors of doing this every single day, of making it through a floor routine with four passes. Like, what's amazing about the Americans is they can do these routines, they can make it through. And if you look at Russian gymnasts who are not really well conditioned, they're like, they can't like make it through a four pass routine. And if you look at they're certainly not as well conditioned as the Americans. So I think, you know, you still see some of that old body type. It's just really depending on where the country is placing the emphasis.
And over those four decades or so, the U.S. has gone from good to utterly dominant. Mm-hmm. How'd that happen?
Well, I mean, a lot of this will be attributed to Marta and Bella Caroli, who defected to the United States in 1981. And I think they brought with them...
From Romania.
I think they brought with them an emphasis and conditioning that hadn't really been in women's gymnastics in general. I think that's one of the things they brought to women's gymnastics, both when they were in Romania and made their big splash in 76 to the United States, that their athletes would just always be really, really fit. And also, as I said earlier, in American gymnastics, it was out of community programs. It wasn't like this highly professional thing where a gymnast would train for 6 hours a day and sort of work their school and the rest of their life around their training. And they brought that sort of regimen to the United States, where athletes are now doing what they call two-a-days, you know, training in the morning, doing school hours, and then coming back in the evenings. They brought that with them. So I think they sort of upped the preparation level. And I also think they brought an expectation of winning. You know, I was thinking about this when I was watching the British team, which is such a talented bunch of girls. And really, they won their first medal at the World Championships last year. And it was such a huge achievement. And they're really good. And I'm thinking that they're still, like happy to be there, happy to be in that group. And there's such a difference between, gosh, I'm just happy to be here and I deserve a medal mentality. And I think the Carolis brought that we deserve medal mentality to the United States. And kind of before... they really did deserve the medals. Like, the Americans are starting to feel like they deserve medals before they were, like, really in that top group. And I think, though, the expectation of winning is a really important part of this, because the sport is so hard and so mentally challenging and it's terrifying that you really have to, like, walk in like you own the place. And, like, that you not only are you happy to be there, you belong there. And then with the breakup of the Soviet Union, the United States has been the largest beneficiary of their coaching talent. And so starting the early and mid-90s, you have all these coaches coming to the United States, and they're opening up gyms. Before, where it was like four or five gyms, if you were an elite gymnast in the United States, you had to go to one of those five gyms if you wanted to make it to the Olympics. Now, all of a sudden, there are like a lot of gyms where a high-level gymnast could train. So that means that kids don't necessarily have to leave their families. Maybe now training at the elite level is more palatable to more athletes. And also, it means it's easier to find that talent. Like, the more gyms you have, the likelier it is that you're going to find the Simone Biles. You know, Simone Biles just happened to walk into a gym. And it was a canceled daycare trip. And so they took that because of bad weather, so they took him to a gym. And so having that club system, that large network, also acts as an enormous dragnet on talent. And then they built up this semi-centralized training system where, using Simone Biles as coach as an example, she, you know, Simone Biles was identified pretty early on as being someone who had a lot of talent. And so she gets invited to these developmental camps before the national training camps, and her coach goes with her. And the coach is then educated on how to train her at this level. And Amy Borman has said repeatedly that, you know, she felt fortunate that this system existed, because she now was able to say that she's the coach and Olympic champion, whereas when Simone first walked into her gym, she didn't have all those tools, and she got them by going to these training camps.
I'm seeing that Deborah Myers, author of The End of the Perfect 10, The Making and Breaking of Gymnastics' Top Score from Nadia to Now, published by Touchstone.
I always wonder how these things are funded. How do these girls live while they're being trained? And who funds all the coaches and the equipment and all that?
Well, I mean, they're private gyms, so you pay tuition to the gyms. And so that's how the gyms pay for all this equipment and sharing.
So the families have to have some resources?
Yeah, it's not a sport for poor kids. And especially as it moved away from that community model that had existed early on into a private club model. And that shift really started to happen after 1984 when Mary Lou won her gold medal. And the, membership at gyms just sort of skyrocketed. So after 1984, you really start to see a dip in like things like high school gymnastics and NCAA gymnastics and YMCAs and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, you can't be poor. And then when the girls get to the national team level, so that's a lot of years, and that's a lot of money that the family has already laid out. If they are named to the national team, they can get a stipend that is sent to their gym to help, defray the cost of training. So, because it used to be if you accepted that stipend, if it was directed to the girl, they could lose their NCAA eligibility. And so now it's really important that that goes not to the athletes, because a lot of these girls will end up with full scholarships to an NCAA program, and you don't want to ruin that for them.
With the shift from Soviet to American dominance, there's been a shift in the nature of those sports that went from being sort of artistic and balletic to being more athletic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you write, there's actually a kind of a racial subtext to some of that commentary. So could you talk about the meaning of that shift?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Soviets, I mean, Russians are obsessed with ballet, and it was all, like, and dance, and it was all over their gymnastics. So even though the Russians and the Soviets were doing the most difficult skills, it wasn't like they were slouches. They were the innovators in a lot of these skills. They also were really committed to choreography. And one Russian coach said that, like, in the Soviet system, a choreographer would be working with these girls at a super young age. Whereas in the American system, it's like once you get to a high level, then maybe you start to get some dance training where you're like, oh, like now that we know that you're going to be competing at the World Championships, we'll teach you some ballet. But it's already kind of a little late to sort of get that training going. And I think as it shifted to U.S. dominance, first of all, like we don't have, I think, a guiding set of aesthetic principles in the United States the way someplace like Russia has.
Pervades the culture.
That pervades the culture. So there isn't, and it so becomes more of this athletic sensibility. And also because as the scoring system becomes more technical, it's hard to reward that kind of artistry. So when you don't have a way to incentivize it, it sort of starts to fall away. And so even the Russian gymnast at this Olympics and someone like Alia Mustafina, who has just this, you can see the dance training all over her. Like her carriage is beautiful, like my friend said last night. She's like, she's really figured out how to use her elbows, which I'm not quite, my friend's a dancer. I was like, I guess I see that. But even her floor routine is, in terms of its choreographic content, is super weak at this point, and weaker than most of the Americans, because she's just trying to survive her tumbling skills at this point. And so you're starting, so because it becomes more athletic, it's harder to devote the same kind of resources to dance. And there's really no way to reward it. Like the things that get rewarded in terms of dance are like these really hard turns, which are just kind of tricks unto themselves and really no different than doing a full twisting double back.
Now, you quote a couple of Italians saying some really nasty things, right?
Yeah, back in 2013, after Simone Biles, who just won her the Olympic gold medal that everyone was predicting, but back then, she was just 16, she was new on the scene, and she just won her first world title. And one of the Italians, after the all-around ceremony, had said to the Italian media, she said to her teammates, that if we paint our faces black, we can also win. Because obviously in 2012, Gabby Douglas had won the Olympic all-around title. So I guess this gymnast was sensing a trend, to back-to-back black women winning major gymnastics titles. And obviously that blew up and she apologized, but the spokesperson for the Italian Gymnastics Federation posted on Facebook and it like tried to explain it, which is just never a good idea. Someone says something racist, don't try to explain it, just apologize. And he's posited that this gymnast was talking about how the rules now favor more athletic gymnastics, you know, and he used the term color, that colored, you know, gymnasts excel at versus the elegant European, which, you know, the subtext is white. And it was really interesting for me to read because the year before I had written an article positing that artistry was like coded language for body type in gymnastics, when a lot of times they would say, oh, that gymnast is so artistic, it was like, she's skinny. You know, like, and meaning she doesn't have the muscular body type. And
it's also balletic.
Balletic, yeah. And so there it was interesting to see it used as a coded language for race, because you were saying that Simone Biles was athletic and not artistic. And I would say that she, especially her presentation on the floor, she dances a lot better than a lot of the gymnasts. She can be both. But they're saying, oh, it's an either or. And black gymnasts are just athletic, and white gymnasts are elegant.
But, and you said a study of, was it the commentary on basketball, right, where the athletes are described in with different adjectives.
Yeah, that white athletes are generally spoken about in terms of their intelligence or their scrappiness or their hard work. And black athletes are talked about in terms of their athletic abilities and their natural raw talent. And as a way of, you know, saying that, like, they don't really work for this. And they're not smart. That's right. Like that's, you know, that's the implication, that they're not smart and that they didn't work hard for it.
And you know, to someone who is not very deeply immersed in athletics, it's easy not to realize how much of the head is involved as well as the body.
Yeah, I mean, I think that came up when I think Donovan McNabb was named, he became like the first black quarterback, and that's considered to be the intelligent position, or one of the intelligent positions in football, and that had previously been restricted to white men, and there was a whole sort of controversy over that, like, you know, because we had been told that black athletes are not smart, but they're just talent, right? Like, they're just the brute force, and the brains is the white guy throwing the ball. When, like, the first black quarterback is named, it became, like a lot of horrible racist stuff came out.
So the 2016 Olympics are not over as we record this, but what do you think of the competition so far?
I mean, on the men's side, it's absolutely thrilling. I feel bad for people who don't pay attention to men's gymnastics. On the women's side, it's really exciting to see the dominance of Simone Biles. It's really exciting. It's amazing to see someone who had been, like, we had been predicting that she was going to do this well, but it's a lot to live up to, and you don't necessarily know that someone can handle it. That's a lot of pressure. And in gymnastics in the past, you've definitely seen the favorite fall. So when the favorite does exactly what we've been predicting for 2 years at least, when she really does it and she's performing at her peak and not at all like crumbling under the pressure, because last year at the World Championships, she admitted that she felt the pressure to repeat as become the first consecutive three-time world champion. And she still won because she has such a huge advantage over the field in terms of her scoring potential. But, like, she's not even doing that. Like, she could have taken a fall and won last night, and she didn't. And so it's exciting to see someone really be able to compete at that level. And the Americans are the same. It's just, you know, there's just a mastery there. But at the same time, it's a little disappointing when you see just how far behind the rest of the field is lagging. It's the sport of, in women's gymnastics, the sport is much, much less competitive. I remember being at...
You mean other countries?
Other countries. Yeah. And really... are not as good as they once were. China is great and still has the potential to be a threat, and really, realistically, is only slightly behind the United States in terms of their overall difficulty, but their execution, their ability to hit isn't there. I remember at Olympic trials, I was talking to someone, and, you know, everyone's, like, trying to figure out who's going to be the Olympic team, and she just kind of said, it doesn't matter. Like you can, if you put this person on the Olympic team, they win by 4 points. You put this person on the Olympic team, they win by 5 points. But this is the situation we're in, is the United States is so dominant that any team they're going to put together is going to win by several points. And now the only question is how many points? And if you like sports, you want to see a real fight, like the men's all around. On the other day, it was like a fight down to a tenth. And no one was blinking. Everyone was just hitting. And that was incredible. And here, it's not quite the same thrill.
Right. That was Deborah Myers, author of The End of the Perfect 10, published by Touchstone. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, under the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
That was some of Svetlana, a song about Stalin's daughter by the 1980s band XEX. Next, Arun Gupta. Arun is a journalist who's been covering the working class, among many other things, for years now. The Service Employees International Union, SEIU, an organization that talks a better game than it delivers, has been funding the fight for 15, as in the $15 an hour minimum wage. Unfortunately, SEIU is paying many of the organizers in that campaign about $9 an hour. Here's Arun Gupta with that story, and on the questionable politics behind the whole fight, plus a postscript on Donald Trump. You've discovered that many of the workers who are organizing in the name of SEIU's Fight for 15 campaign are themselves not making 15 an hour, right?
Yeah. The organizers claim that once they add in the number of hours they actually work, they often work 60-hour weeks, and they also, and I've heard this from numerous organizers, they spend a lot of their time driving, and so they have to pay for gas out of pocket, and so once they end up factoring in those expenses, their pay could come out to as little as $9 an hour, which now is below minimum wage in some of the cities they're organizing in.
They all went to a convention, right? And you frequented that and talked to a lot of people. What was that like?
Well, it was pretty interesting. I think people who are familiar with labor organizing wouldn't entirely be surprised, even though it is a bit distressing. So just to set the stage, now, SEIU claimed this is the first Fight for 15 National Convention. That's simply not true. This is at least the fourth annual convention of the fast food worker movement. It started funding back in 2011. It didn't appear until November 2012, but SEIU started the funding in 2011. And so now what it's done is it's trying to make it a broader low-wage workers movement. So it's bringing in home health care aides and child care workers. In fact, it's launches Child Care Fight for 15, kind of this sub-movement. So when you talk about these sectors of the economy, who's employed in it, it's a lot of Black women. And also African-American men, but there was just tons of Black women, especially inside the convention. And then secondarily, Latinas, Latinos. So it's overwhelmingly people of color. This is really the working class. And, you know, I think at one level, some credit should be given to SEIU that they are putting a lot of these workers in motions. They have been instrumental in making low wages a national issue. But at the same time, then when you see who is the leadership, it's really overwhelmingly white. There are a lot of women in the leadership. But, you know, when looking around the convention, it was kind of obvious that the white guys were the ones in the leadership position. You know, they're not the home health care aides. They're not the child care workers within SEIUs. This leads into what the political positioning. Mary Kay Henry, the president of SEIU, gave a speech. It was just, you know, filled with a lot of platitudes. But one could read the political strategy. And so they, the SEIU political strategy is they are basically putting African Americans first. In a multiracial coalition, that they're the ones who are going to be leading this political struggle, leading the other races.
No, but leading in what sense? I mean, they giving making strategy and giving orders, or are they just the faces in front of the cameras?
They're the faces in front of the cameras. They're trying to make this into a new civil rights movement. So one of the big things that came out of this convention, and this is all predetermined, right? There's a lot of talk SEIU like, oh, the workers are in charge, you know, and folks who've been following this, they know for the first year or so when it had surfaced, SEIU was even denying that they had any primary role. And then I wrote that big expose in these Times showing that, no, this was all conceived, funded, organized by SEIU from the beginning. So now they're trying to present this as kind of this natural fusion of the low-wage workers movement with the Black Lives Matter movement. They're trying to now make this a new civil rights movement, but there's a whole strategy to this. And the strategy is clientelism, that SEIU is trying to mobilize forces that it will then use in demonstrations and quote-unquote strikes, civil disobedience, to pressure the Democratic Party in these external matters, and also through voting, right? They want to be able to bring a lot of people to the polls and then say, turn around and say to the Democrats, hey, we did this, and so now you got to give us our payback. Now, you might be able to explain it better than me, the whole, like, kerfuffle over the home health care organizing in California with SEIU. You remember that?
Oh, no. Are you talking about the home health care or the nursing homes?
The nursing homes.
Yeah, they would make deals with employers. They'd say, well, we'll only organize a few of these. We won't organize the rest, and we won't make too many demands, and we'll write contracts and make it illegal for workers to blow whistle on bad treatment, and then we'll lobby with you in Sacramento. So they basically became the junior partners of their employers in order to get bigger numbers and more dues income. So I don't know. Is this the kind of model that they're bringing?
Classic corporatism, right? And so, but then not only that, they actually lobbied against a patient's bill of rights.
Yes.
And so they were actually lobbying against the health of the people in the nursing homes. Well, it looks like they're trying the same exact strategy in the childcare industry. So I was talking to childcare organizers and I was like, who are you organizing? And they're like, well, we're organizing childcare workers, we're organizing childcare directors, and we're organizing childcare owners. And I was like, what? I was like, what do you mean by childcare owners? The people who own the childcare facility. Toward what end? Well, the idea is that we'll all come together and lobby the government, particularly the federal government, to increase payments for childcare because it's in the best interests in the development of children and strengthening communities. And I was just like, holy, you know,
word you can't say on the radio. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. This is the same type of strategy. That's what it appears like, where they're going to strike deals, be like, hey, help us put pressure on the federal government. But of course, what happens, as you point out with the nursing home, the owners aren't just going to be like, sure, we want more money. No, they're going to want other stuff, like no strike clauses or, you know, agreement to lower standards or to not enforce standards or, you know, that at least have the workers not make any noise about cutting corners.
And, you know, what this strategy yields is not higher wages for workers or more worker power at all. I mean, in many cases, you know, it keeps a lid on wages, at least from what I've heard about the nursing home situation in California. So what do we expect out of this strategy?
Well, you know, that's the thing. There's been all this hype for the last few months. This may be the time that they're finally going to announce a union, because that's the whole thing. It's been $15 and the union. Now, there's a while there, like in 2014 and 2015, where it just became about the $15. But now in the last year, we've been hearing more about the union. And this goes back years. I was told this by senior level organizers back in 2013 that it's not going to be a traditional union. You know, it would be modeled on something like maybe a worker center, you know, where you pay monthly dues, or it would be some sort of affiliated association. And yet they came out of the convention with no movement toward a union at all, which is kind of interesting on the one hand, because SEIU wants to see a return on its investment. But I think at this point, the return they see is all the good press that they've gotten. They've been able to burnish their opinion, not only in the public eye, but crucially on the left as well. You know, like when I see a lot of the labor journalists who write about the SEIU and Fight for 15, of course these issues are real. Of course the workers are in dire circumstances and need all the help that they can get. But there's a lot of just really uncritical reporting, acting like as if this is the second coming of the CIO and, you know, and the sit-down strikes in the late 1930s.
Now, not to be too cynical about this, but SEIU does give money to a lot of these publications and organizations.
Well, yes, that is true also. And, you know, I've had some people who've told me to follow the money, like the National Employment Labor Project, which they put out a lot of great reports. But people have claimed to me that they have a lot of these academics who are doing these reports are also getting money from SEIU as well. This was one of those light bulb moments. I talked to one of the senior labor strategists in the country who explained, you know, that you don't do an organizing project of this scale without having a series of nested strategies, right? There isn't just one particular goal. It's not just about organizing fast food workers. SEIU is trying to increase its influence in the Democratic Party. It's trying to get a better public image. But one of the crucial things also that I think it's trying to do is to improve its image on the left, because it had a pretty bad image because of Andy Stern. What he was pursuing wasn't even corporatism. I mean, he was just wanted SEIU to be essentially the gendarme for capital. There was he's a former president before Mary Kay Henry, and he gave this absurd interview about a decade ago to the Wall Street Journal where he was lamenting, why can't the U.S. corporations understand that the unions return value?
Adolf Reed once said that Andy Stern's vision of the labor movement was as one giant human resources department.
Right, yeah. And so it's just like, if that is your argument, that you're going to get greater profit with unions, what is the point of unions? You might as well become a Communist Party China-style union.
And I neglected to ask you earlier what SEIU's reaction was to the protests coming from these organizers who are complaining about making pennies in wages.
They retaliated against them. First of all, on the inside, they were attacked from the stage, and I think it was pretty unseemly. They didn't want to call it a demonstration. They were trying to deliver a letter. They were saying it was a peaceful action. And before they could get to the stage, security stopped them. Mary Kay Henry steps back behind this wall of brown folk, the National Organizing Committee, some of the National Organizing Committee for Fight for 15. One woman starts, grabs the microphone on stage and starts berating the organizers who are demanding $15 an hour in a union. She starts berating them. Are you serious? You're going to do this here now? You know, do you know what it's like to live on $500 every 2 weeks? You know, do you know what it's like to be living in a van, you know, and have your babies living in a van? You know, they don't know our struggle. They've not walked a mile in our shoes. You know, and it was just like, wow, really? You're going to turn the working class against each other? That's your strategy, and that's what it really does appear to be. Yeah, maybe these workers are making, like, you know, in the mid-30s, but that's pretty hard to get by, especially a lot of them are college-educated and are carrying large debts. I talked to one organizer who took part, and she's like, I'm carrying $35,000 in student loan debt and nearly an equal amount, and she's like, you know, this is about lifting everyone up, not about, you know, being crabs in a barrel and tearing each other down. But as a result of this, what SEIU did was one of their national directors allegedly called up the folks involved, the leaders who led this little impromptu demonstration. It was actually planned, and they said it was close to 100 people total. But five of the organizers were flown home the next morning. They were told, you're not going to participate in the actions on Saturday, which they had been organizing for months. And they were also told, you're going to have to pay for your own hotel rooms. And now this was just a total amateur move on their part, because it's just like, that's just really nasty and retaliatory. It's not going to stick. And in fact, SEIU appears to have already backed off from that demand. They were, of course, worried about further retaliation because at least one of the organizers, and this is the union of union representatives that they're trying to organize with, one of the organizers has been fired, and UUR has filed an unfair labor practice on their behalf, and
UGR also said they're going to file another on Monday, August 14th, a second unfair labor practice. So the whole thing is just really scandalous because SEIU is essentially engaged in the same practices that it accuses a McDonald's of. It's outsourcing its own workers, trying to claim that it's not responsible for them, and then when they try to unionize, it's retaliating against them and allegedly firing some of them.
I'm speaking with the journalist Arun Gupta. Now, some people might be listening to this and say, okay, maybe this all sounds a little fishy, but maybe the result of all this is that the workers will get higher wages, and maybe we will move towards 15. So is that possible under this arrangement?
We have seen that, right? You know, in California, in New York State, in Seattle, and then you have a lot of places that are like Portland, Oregon is going to move towards 14.75. And again, you know, for people who are struggling on 7.25 an hour, one should never poo-poo. Like, I hear people saying, like, oh, they should be fighting for 20 or 25. Like, look, if you're scraping by, this means a lot. And let's recognize it, that it is a victory. But at the same time, Seattle, which that was actually, I covered that closely. That was the first $15 bill. But the thing about Seattle is they have a tiered system. It's pretty complicated. There's like, I think, six different categories. But those whose wages are rising the fastest, that's basically workers at McDonald's, Burger King, Starbucks, who don't have health care, are now at $13 an hour. But when you look at the rent, and this is really related, like I think actually the biggest working class issue now is not really wages, it's housing costs. We are seeing an extraordinary and extreme rise in housing costs. Since the Seattle $15 bill went into effect, average rents in Seattle have increased $354 a month. So I'm taking to calling these $15 bills the Landlord Wage Transfer Act. Because that's effectively what's going on, that yes, you're getting higher wages, but you're seeing just the money go straight out of your pocket into the landlords because you're not building worker power. You can't address these issues one at a time. You have to have a force that is taking on a number of that understands the whole interrelation and that the issues are about the reproduction of daily life. So unless you're starting to move towards like a politics that address that, which is what socialism is about, these gains are going to be eroded incredibly fast.
You made a joke earlier about the Chinese Communist Party and their unions, but SEIU is practically a branch of the Democratic Party, it seems like. I talked to a fairly senior guy at SEIU a few months ago who worried that they endorsed Hillary too late. And I said, what are you kidding me? I mean, what do you gain by an early endorsement? Wouldn't you have more leverage if you hold out a bit? And he said, oh, no. And I think they're afraid of retaliation and vindictiveness on the part of the Clintons, who are famous for that sort of thing. But you know, like the relation between this campaign and the Democratic Party seems rather intimate, isn't it?
SEIU organizers and strategists have been telling me for 3 years that the strategy is to increase their influence in the Democratic Party. Before, I think they were looking at a lot of northern states and coastal states. Now they're pursuing a southern strategy, which makes sense in terms of trying to recast this as a civil rights movement. But it's, again, it's once more, it's the image, not the substance of a civil rights movement. So in mid-September, they're planning this day of action in southern state capitals, where they're going to have demonstrations, reportedly orchestrated civil disobedience, and quote-unquote strikes. You know, this is one of the things that there are a number of people, myself included, and Jay McAlevey points this out. It's just like, it's not a strike unless you're stopping the point of production. You know, getting two people to skip work from Burger King is not a strike.
According to your reports, they've spent something like $100 million or more on this campaign. They're not paying the organizers a living wage by any means. Where is all this money going?
A huge amount is going towards consultants and law firms. We know that a lot is going to Berlin Rosen,
which is a publicity and lobbying group.
Yeah, it's kind of the big Democratic, like kind of the left wing of the Democratic Party. They're very prominent in the de Blasio administration.
I keep coming across Berlin Rosen in my reporting. Berlin Rosen was involved in the People's Climate March, which was a hijacking of a more radical march in 2014. It was meant to be a Seattle-style confrontation where people were going to actually blockade the United Nations, and it was going to be a reverse blockade. The idea was they're going to blockade and not let any of the delegates or officials leave until they came up with a real climate plan, and then the liberal groups and unions came in and hijacked it and rebranded it as this People's Climate March that was a march on the weekend in deserted streets to nowhere. Berlin Rosen was also involved in the attempted hijacking of the Occupy movement, the 99% spring. Back in 2012, which again SEIU was also heavily involved in. It's really this kind of like postmodern politics that keeps cropping up again and again. And one childcare worker who I talked to, like she told me, I am passionate about finding childcare workers who can be effective spokespeople before the national media about their lives and issues. That's not organizing. That's a march on the media. You're just trying to find people who can be like get before the camera and effectively tell their story in 30 seconds.
Sounds like a Democratic convention.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's been the SEIU strategy from the beginning. Like when I've probed both workers and organizers, what are they actually doing? Like what tools? How are they actually training workers in shop, how to like fight on the shop floor, how to organize workers, build trust, be able to stand up against the boss, like stop retaliation or strike back to make life hell for the bosses on the shop floor. They're like, none of that goes on. The only training we get is media training. And the leaders, quote unquote, are the ones who can speak best before the cameras. That's the thing. I think on the one hand, you know, SEIU deserves credit for making this a national issue and for helping to propel these $15 an hour bills that will make a difference in the lives of a lot of people. But if you are really interested in systemic social change, this is the complete opposite of it. There is no worker power being built. There's also incredibly high turnover among both workers and organizers. A lot of organizers independently over the years have told me that their hiring for the field organizers is a Teach for America model, where basically SEIU gets young people who've been out of college a couple of years, they throw them into the field, they overwork them, burn them out, and they either then fire them or they quit, and then they get a new batch.
And let's shift gears just for the last few minutes of this. You've been spending a lot of time going to Trump rallies, and first of all, you don't look like your standard Trump supporter, so how are you received when you've gone to these things?
Well, you know, what I would say, you got to understand that unless you're dealing with outright neo-Nazis or Klansmen, the right wing loves to have brown people around because it proves they're not racist.
Oh, of course. That proves it. You weren't taunted or anything.
I never have any problem.
More importantly, what did you see at these rallies?
There's been all this talk about, you know, this is not the working class, and it's like BS. This is the working class. Part of the problem is all these analysis of who is a working class are relying on bourgeois notions of what the working class is. The working class is simply, do you sell your labor into the marketplace? If the answer is yes, then you're part of the working class. It's overwhelmingly white, and it's also heavily dudes. When I was at the RNC, it was such a bro fest that the men's bathroom had lines, but the women didn't.
That's unnatural.
Yeah, you know, people who are like, oh, he's not tapping into the white working class. It's like that's BS. You know, he is, and he is very effectively. I think you also have to understand, like, the way I define it is this is a patriarchal white nationalist movement, that the patriarchal is very important.
What animates these folks aside from, white nationalism and patriarchy? Or is that it?
race and class are inexorably intertwined in the American experience, right? Chattel slavery goes hand in hand with the development of American capitalism. So for his supporters, the race and class things are intertwined. So yeah, they want to bring back jobs, but it's they want to bring back jobs by also kicking out Mexicans. Make America great is really a code word for make America white again. One of the interesting things about it is there's what I call trickle-down revenge. Numerous times his supporters have told me they're against like cultural Marxism, and I'm like, whoa, this is really weird. Like, you know, where do they get this language from? And two, this is also like quasi-fascistic. European fascism was, of course, a movement explicitly against Marxism. So now they're defining it as cultural Marxism. And it is about these aggrieved white males, but not just economically aggrieved, but this kind of mix of sexual and racial grievances. Trump constantly attacks people. And, you know, he's just this, like, cannon shot. He's attacked everyone. And the media treats it as a distraction. And I started to think, like, well, no. His supporters are getting a form of satisfaction from this. This enables them to act out their aggression, their kind of revenge fantasies within their own life. And we need a more complicated view of just saying it's just about race or economic grievances. This is also tapping into like some deep psychological needs and desires for revenge and sexualized aggression.
That was the journalist Arun Gupta. You can find his story in the Fight for 15 on the Raw Story website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a song custom made for the Trump supporter. Till next week, bye.